Good morning, everybody.
Good morning.
The Apostle John is renowned for having, towards the end of his life, refined the Christian gospel to three words. And those words are, God is love. In every aspect of John's teachings that we come across, his three letters towards the end of the Bible, his gospel, which he wrote, the last of all the gospels, and of course even in Revelations, we see this being brought across, that John's concept of Christ was to show the love of God revealed in him. So today I would like to look at that love, the love that is God. So to start this off, we have to understand that the love that we're talking about is called agape. It's Greek, so you have to excuse my pronunciation of it. I'm not even going into the others. But that love means, for all intent and purpose, outgoing concern for someone else, or unconditional love, unconditional emotion. When we try to examine that love, when we try to look at it, one thing comes to mind. In our normal human lives, it is almost impossible to see that love, agape love, in action, except in one place. One place it's always observed, and that is the love a mother has for her child. You always see agape love in that. Why, you say? Because here's the unique thing about agape love. Agape love accepts that the person the affection is held for is not perfect. It accepts the fact that they can be rude, unthankful, unconsiderate. They may even be a violent, horrible person. But they still love them anyway. And why is that important? Because that's exactly what God does for us. God accepts the fact that we are unlovable. And we are. We are unlovable. There are times when we are absolutely terrible. We don't appreciate what God does. We don't appreciate how he cares for us or what he does for us. But yet, he still loves us. He cared so much for us that he was willing to give his own son for us. You'll find that in John 3:16. God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten son, that whosoever should believe in him will not perish, but have eternal life. Today, as we look at this subject, what I want to do is show how the messages and the teachings of Jesus epitomized this particular concept of love. I want to use a few examples. Jesus told much of the wisdom that he shared with us in the form of parables. And one parable that keeps coming to mind is the parable of the prodigal son. I'm not going to ask you to turn to it. The prodigal son is a story you all have a basic good understanding of. And the principle of the prodigal son is you have this child who, for all intent and purpose, dishonors his parent because he says, I don't want to wait until you have died. I want to get my inheritance now. I want you to sell so much of your property and give it to me so that I can live my life now rather than waiting another 10, 20 years for you to pop up and I get an omelet. Not a very nice person, we would say. But the father loves this person. The father loves this son. And he agrees. This was a totally disgrace for what was happening. But the father agrees. He sells a portion of his land. He accumulates the money that would be due to go to the son, and he gives it to him. And a few days later, the son heads off to make his fortune in the world. He spends that money having a good time, making friends, basically being his own person, doing whatever he wants to do. But it doesn't take long before the money runs out. It doesn't take long before hard times fall, and a famine falls in the country that he's in. And this young man, as it is, finds himself in a pigsty. Pigsty. Feeding rusks and pigs. And for a young Jew, this is as far as you can go. You cannot go lower than this. This is it. This is the bottom of the barrel. And he gets so hungry that he actually starts to eat the pig's food. He feeds the pigs and he's eating it faster than the pigs can act it. And that's pretty fast because the pigs are greedy. But here's the thought. What was the father doing all the time that the son was away? We're told every day he got up. He anointed himself, he prepared his clothes, he got his breakfast, and he would take a walk. He would go to the end of the road, and he would look up the road where his son had left. And from a good part of the day, as his custom had turned, he continually went and he watched, and he waited. Because his hope, his desire, was that this son would come back. He wasn't worried about the disgrace. He wasn't worried about the dishonour that the son had paid him. His love for the child outweighed all that. Agape love. We know the story. The son, one morning, came to his senses. And he began to reason with himself and he says, you know, here I am, feeding pigs, starving to death, being really stupid. And in my father's house, he's got servants who are eating good food, having a good time, enjoyable life, no worries, no concerns. So what I'm going to do is, I'll go back to him and I will offer to grieve his servant for the way I treated him. I'll apologize. I'll humble myself because, let's face it, I'm as low as it gets. A little bit of humility won't do me any harm. And he heads off. Don't know how much notice to give. Doesn't say. I imagine not. He's that sort of person. So here he is. He's headed home. He's had a long walk. He's decided every way. He's rehearsed the statement, what he's going to say. He knows exactly the words of how he's going to put it. Father, I've sinned against heaven and against you. I am no longer worthy to be called your son. Please make me a servant in your household that I can eat. I made a big mistake. When he was still only a speck on the horizon, when he was still way down the road, his father recognized him. Now, if you were an elderly landowner of immense fortune and prestige in the Middle East, approximately 2,000 years ago, there was a number of things you'd never did. And one of them was run. Now, you might say there might have been reasons for that, but it's all to do with the fact that you never showed yourself to be fussed or hurry and hurry. You always dealt with yourself decorously. But this father, when he saw his son in the distance, just a speck, recognized who it was because he had been so eagerly looking for that son's return, threw decorum out the window. And he galloped towards his son. And when he reached him, the son was getting ready for this big speech, about to start it, had said a few words, but his father dismissed it. Called his servants, put a ring on his finger. A ring represented that he had authority and power as a member of the family, not servant. Put robes on him, dress him in righteousness and truth, so that everyone sees that this my son who was dead has returned to be alive. Now the parable, of course, looks at our relationship with God. And what Jesus is bringing across in the parable is how God views us. You see, we are that prodigal. We have dishonored God. We have went our own path. We have followed our own way. If you like, we have picked a star and sailed towards it. But God has continually sought us out to bring us back. And all of us here sitting in this room have the great privilege of knowing that God actively sought us out. We didn't come to our senses. He came with an invitation for us to come back to him through his son, Jesus Christ. And that's part of the gospel message. There's other parables. There's another parable that shows God's love, his agape love, unconditional. And it's this one. And you're all familiar with it. It's the parable of the Samaritan. Now, just checking here to see that I actually write it down. No, I didn't. Once again, I have failed to do that. But we all know the story of the Samaritan. So, let's take a moment and think about it. A young man, we assume he's young, is attacked on the roadside, deserted place. Bandits have stripped him of his clothes, beat him, left him in his own blood, at the side of the road, for dead. As he's lying there, injured, unable to move, unable to do anything for himself, possibly unconscious, a priest comes in. Now the priest is a religious man. He has a responsibility to serve God. He has the honor and privilege to offer sacrifice before the altar of God. He is God's representative to the people, and on behalf of the people presents God to them. Sends them to God. So this man has prestige. He has understanding. He has a position of authority. And he comes along a part of the road. He looks over. He sees the injured man. And he walks on. Oh my God, what did he walk on for? Well, you see, he had important work to do. That man might have been dead. And if he was dead and he touched him, he couldn't serve at the altar. Because if you touch a corpse, you're unclean. You cannot serve at the altar. So therefore, this priest said, it is more important for me to keep myself holy and sanctified than to help this man. God's expectation on me is to keep myself right, even if it means ignoring this man. And that's exactly what the priest did. Totally ignored him. A little while later, another man, a prominent Jew. We know that this was a teacher of the law, a Pharisee. Someone who understood God's laws and how God thinks and how God reacts and what God expects of us. Because this individual will possibly even have been a rabbi, may even have been teaching people how to interact with God. He looks over, stops, shakes his head, tut-tuts, and goes on. Why? Well, you see, he's got other things to do. He also knows that, you know, you've got to take things. You can't take things always at face value. This could be a trap. This could be a problem. Maybe this man has been left there to catch some poor soul like himself that when he goes to hell, automatically he'd get kicked in the touch and beat up and all the things taken. Could be all a scam. So he's a wise man. He studied the law. He knows not to be taken in. So he goes in. Later down the road, there comes the Samaritan. Now, we've got to understand about the Samaritans. The Samaritans were a people who were brought into Israel when the 10 tribes had been exported out of Israel by the Assyrians. And they were people from all the different areas around that had been put into Israel to fill the land. Now, as custom for most of these pagan peoples was, when you went into a new land, you adopted whatever the god of that land was. So they knew that the god of this land was the living God, the Holy One, the Lord God of Israel. So they naturally adopted the god and incorporated a little bit of their religion into it as well. So the Samaritans were what we would call a mixed religious body. They didn't actually have a purity of religion or a purity of knowledge. But, you know, they did their best. But the Jews considered them worthless, useless, and not people you mix with at all. Yet this Samaritan who was doing business is coming along, and he says to himself, what's up? His approach to this man who is injured lying there was, you know, I travel this road on a regular basis. That could easily have been me. That could have been me. I could have been the man lying there. So he goes over and he checks the man's alive. He's not worried if he's dead, like, because that doesn't affect him. So the man is alive. So he immediately goes to his pack. What he's got, all the stuff that he has, he gets ointments and oils and wrappings, and he cleans the wounds, bandages the man up, gives him a bit of food, tries to get him to talk and conscious again, realizes this man's really badly injured, and he realizes he's going to need help. So he helps the man up, puts him on his own donkey, and walks beside the donkey until they get to the next inn. But this man is so ill, he's been lying there for hours, bleeding, dying, but not dead. And the Samaritan takes him and he puts him in the room and he continues to care for him that entire night. Because he, in his mind, he's thinking to himself, I'd want somebody to do this for me if I was in this bother. The next morning, the Samaritan has to go on about his business. But the man isn't well. So the Samaritan did something that is unique. This is something you don't consider, or the Jews would never consider the Samaritan to even think of. He comes along to the owner of the inn and he says,
no.
My friend is ill. My friend needs treatment. He needs help. He needs time to recover. Here is a bag of gold. Maybe it's silver. We'll not get into that. But here is a bag of money. Hopefully it's enough. Hopefully it's enough for him to fully recover without costing more. But in the case that it's not, in case that he's still so ill when this money is redone, I'm asking you to meet up to the missing bit and keep an account of it. And when I come back here in a couple of months' time, I will square you whatever else it took to get this man well and fit. And he went on his way. Jesus stops the parable there and asks the question. Who was a neighbour to that hurt man? And all the people said, the one who cared for him. They didn't say the Samaritan, they said the one who cared for him. Why? Because Samaritan was... That was a filthy word in their lips. So they just said the one who cared for him. They didn't even understand the principle of the story then. But what did that Samaritan show? Was he a man of God? No. Jesus' definition of being a Samaritan indicated that he didn't know God. We know this because when Jesus was talking to the Samaritan woman at the well, he told her in no uncertain terms, the Jews know who they worship, but you Samaritans do not know anything about who you worship. You really don't know. And that was the problem. So when he was using this analogy, he was showing that this man knew nothing about God. Yet, what he did was demonstrate agape love to a stranger lying on the side of the road. Why am I telling you this? Why have I bothered telling you about agape love today? Because I want to explain something about it. John tells us very directly that God's love for us is agape. That is, this love for us is unconditional. But there's another element to it that we have to understand. You see, agape love means when you look at a person, you do not judge them by their standing. You do not judge them by their background. You do not judge them by their belief structure. You judge them by you. And you look at them as if they were you. And you say to them, from the point of view of, what would I like at this point? What do I need? How would I like to be treated? And by doing so, you show agape love, because you're not, as it were, putting a condition to the relationship. Doesn't matter what they behave like. Doesn't matter what they do. Doesn't matter what they say. Doesn't matter who they are. Your love for them has to be pure. Now, in reality, what you're doing is you are taking the concept of love and you are making the person to whom it's applying to of equal status to yourself, and then you're putting them on pedestals because you're saying they need more care. Jesus did that. He did that with everyone. But the most profound image of it was just prior to the crucifixion. After the Last Supper, Jesus took a towel, he wrapped it around himself, a bowl of water, he sat down, and he washed the disciples' feet. Might have been before the Last Supper, but it was around that. It's in the water. Peter objected. Peter said, "You do not wash my feet." Now, you may say that's a strange thing for him to say, but there was a reason for it. You see, to wash the feet was considered the most menial of tasks. The lowest of the low of the servants would do it. Basically, it was the bottom of the pile of jobs. And for the master of the house, or even a rabbi, as Jesus was considered, to do it, that brought disgrace and dishonor to themselves. So when Peter was saying, "You'll not wash my feet," he's not actually saying, "No, I'm not having you touching my toes." It's not a problem. He's thinking about Jesus' honor. He's thinking about his position. He's thinking about how he should be presenting himself. He's thinking about all the wrong things. So Jesus reminds him, "Look, if I don't wash your feet, you can't have a relationship with me. You can't have anything to do with me. Because what I'm doing, you will understand later." And what was he doing? What Jesus was giving us an example of the agape love. He was showing us that when we approach each other, we are to assume that the other person is held in higher regard than us. So if you meet someone who's older than yourself, you are to give them the same regard as you would to a parent. If you meet someone that's younger than yourself, you give them the same regard as you would to a son or a daughter. If you meet someone that's similar age to yourself, you treat them as a brother or a sister. You don't treat them as different. At all times, you treat them as you would normality yourself. And that's very important. Because this concept, this agape love, is so important to God that he emphasizes it throughout the entire Bible. Everywhere we go, he is referring to it. He is showing it. He is demonstrating it. For example, love your neighbor. Love your neighbor as yourself. Perfect agape love. Love the Lord thy God with all thy heart and with all thy soul and with all thy mind. Perfect agape love. When someone asks you or forces you to carry a load for them for a mile, whatever the reason, whether soldier, police, army, whatever, Do it. Do it as if you were doing it for a friend who needed help. Just take it. And therefore, do it to further than you would have before. If you asked your mind, go to. That attitude is a giving. That attitude is the love God talks about. But why do we need it? Well, you see, I mentioned earlier that a person who has who uses and demonstrates this type of love views people to be the same as themselves. And this is the unique concept of it. Because this is what God's doing. And this is the bit that causes the most problems in the world today, especially among theologians. God, the divine, holy, righteous Father in heaven, who is over all things, looks upon each and every one of us as if we were the same as him. He doesn't say, well, I'm God and you're God. No. He wants to have that relationship with us that can only be measured by equals. He wants us to be equal to him. Now, I'm not by any means saying that you are all gods. Don't misunderstand me. You are not equal to God. But God's perception of you, to have a relationship with you, is that you have to become as he is. And to do that, he had to deal with a problem. And that problem is, he is alive and you are dead. He needed you to be alive. But he also needed you to be righteous. And let's face it, when it comes to righteousness, we're not exactly good at it. Because to be righteous means to be right. I know sometimes we meet people who are always right, but that doesn't make them righteous. Being righteous means you really are right. And God is righteous. And Jesus Christ is righteous. And it has been given to us through Christ that we are made righteous. For one purpose. That you can walk into the throne room of God in heaven and you are an equal to the Father and can speak to him face to face. Father to son. Father to daughter. Friend to friend. That's the wonderful thing God has given to us. And that's what agape love is about. That's why we need it. So, all of you, of course, have to demonstrate this love in every aspect of your life. But how do you do that? How do you demonstrate agape love? Well, first of all, let's understand one thing. When you are approached, as God was today, was the request to pray for someone?
No. No.
Gus didn't know who that girl was. I can tell you a wee bit about her, but I'll do it after this sermon because this goes live on the internet, and so I don't want to go into too much detail there. Gus didn't know her. But because we presented her to him, he didn't ask any questions. He read what was there. He made the prayer to God on behalf of us all, and we all joined in. And that's exactly what agape love is. Not questioning, accepting that if you've been asked to do something, if you've been asked to do something by someone else, then you should just do it. Now, obviously, there are restraints. If somebody in the world asks you to do something, you question things. You get a bit like that Pharisee who we were chatting about earlier, you know, might be a trick. We have to be as wise as serpents at times, but also as harmless as doves, and that's an important concept. But when it comes to prayer, when it comes to when somebody asks us to pray, we are not to make a judgment call. We're not to wonder, I wonder if this person's a Christian. I wonder if this person, has been affected by something else. I wonder if this person is making a proper commitment. I wonder if they have enough faith. None of that's relevant. All our job is to present the request before the Father. Now, this is where the importance of agape love comes in. You see, if we experience true love as God experiences love, if we are showing that, then when we come into the Father's presence, He sees Jesus Christ coming before us. He sees a request from His own begotten Son, who He loves dearly. And He responds instantly. If you have agape love operating within your life, you have answers to every prayer you utter. See, answers. I didn't say they're always positive. They're answers. Everything is given. You say, well, surely if you ask God for something, He's going to say yes. Not always. I want to give you an example of something. It's one of the most powerful examples of agape prayer or agape love that needs to be looked at. And you'll find it happened in the Garden of Gethsemane. And this is one I'm actually going to ask you to turn to. It's Matthew 26, verse 34 to 44. Matthew 26, 34 to 44. And Jesus came with them to a place called Gethsemane and said to the disciples, "Sit here while I go over and pray there." He took with him Peter and the two sons of Zebedee and began to be sorrowful and deeply distressed. And he said to them, "My soul is exceedingly sorrowful, even to death. Stay here and watch with me." Then he went a little further, fell on his face, prayed, saying, "Oh, my Father, is it possible, if it is possible, let this cup pass from me. Nevertheless, not as I will, but as you will." We'll stop there a moment. What did Jesus just ask? Seriously, what did Jesus just ask? He asked not to have to go through the next few hours.
No.
He asked God to take it away. This was important. You see, at this moment in the garden, Jesus had to make the decision. He had to agree to become the sacrificial lamb. Oh, it was the Father's intention from the beginning, yes. He knew all about that. But you see, at no point did the Father say to him, "You're doing it." He merely said, "Will you do it?" And this is where that comes out. You see, Jesus Christ was wrestling with the full range of human emotion. He was aware of the pain and suffering and disgrace and humiliation that he was about to experience. He was aware of the agonizing death. But more importantly, he was aware that for one time period, not long in reality terms from our point of view, but an eternity for him, he was going to be cut off from God. Unacceptable. He would become a sacrifice. Cursed. God would leave him. And that weighed on him. We're told sorrowful, stressed, and in another place it says that he sweated blood. And that when a person is under great stress, science tells us that's sometimes what they will do. They will actually produce blood in their sweat as it comes down their face. Jesus. But he didn't just stop there. He got up. He went back to his disciples in verse 43. He came and he found them asleep. Well, you know, they're useless. But that's normal. They're human. They're as dependable as a chocolate teapot. And that's something you have to understand. Jesus had to see the disciples at their weakest and useless point at this time, because they weren't meant to be there to support him. They were there to show him that what he was doing with the people who didn't even understand what he was doing, that he was going to have to sacrifice himself, and they didn't even appreciate the seriousness of the situation. So he says to Ruth, are you still sleeping and resting? The hour is coming and is at hand, and the Son of Man is being betrayed into sinners. He got angry with him. In another part of the chapter, you will find that this prayer that he made occurred three times. Three times he went. You'll not see it here in Matthew, it's in one of the other Gospels. Three times he went and prayed the same prayer to God. Three times the Father didn't respond. But at the final, he was comforted by an angel. But before that happened, each time in between the prayer, he had went off to see the disciples, and they were fast asleep. He woke them up, told them, tarry with me, work with me, help me here, pray with me. It's important, I need your help, I need your support. And he went off, prayed, broke his heart before God, and would come back to them, and they were asleep. How could you be motivated to make such a decision when you've got people supporting you like that? And that's part and parcel. Three times Jesus had the option of saying, no, not going to do it. Satan wasn't here. He wasn't involved with this. You see, this had to be Jesus' own decision. He had to be willing to accept the fate of being the sacrificial lamb. And he had to do it through agape love. And that's what he did. He told God how he felt about it. He said he wasn't happy, but he said, if there's no other way, and he asked God to check, is there any other way? Can we work a way around this? Anything at all? Give me an idea. Anything. I'm willing to do whatever it takes. But God was sad. Die was cast. God's plan on this was that it had to be true. And Jesus agreed. So he did. Would you die for your children? Of course, many of us say we would, but really, if your child was not in a perfect relationship with you, some people have children that are estranged from them for different reasons. If your child maybe has had a falling out with you or a difficulty and you're just not seeing eye to eye with them at that moment in time, and somebody says, will you die for me? Would you be able to say yes? Or would you think about it? That's all that happens here. Jesus wants to think about it. And when you realise the situation of mankind and humanity, we understand why he wants to think about it. But he went through with it because of his love for you and for me. His love is what did the difference. I'm going to close just with a thought. When somebody comes to you and says, would you anoint me? Would you pray for me? Would you look into my circumstances? And you respond to them, of course. Remember this, that when you walk before the throne of God to make that request, you're standing in front not just of a great creator king who has all power and authority. You're standing before a father who desires to say yes to everything you ask him. Because he loves you more than he loves himself. That is agape love.